Dave Rabbit here again with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. If you love politics and are tired of hearing and reading all that robotic crap that keeps churning out from the mainstream media, then come join me and thousands of people from around the world at AbovePolitics.com. They have political forums for everyone's taste, including U.S. politics, United Kingdom politics, Canadian politics, head-to-head political debates, politics of war. They have a general chit-chat and a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies to the political arena. There's also forums about Mideast conflict, socialism. They have a slugfest, liberalism, conservatism, moderate, and my personal favorite, military and security issues. So if you don't want to be another sheep and want to be a unique thinker, AbovePolitics.com is for you. Part of the Above Network, LLC. Deny apathy. AbovePolitics.com.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From AboveTopSecret.com.
Oh, crap!
Hi, John.
Hi, Dave. Wow, this is kind of an interesting way of doing an intro for an interview, don't you think?
I love this part. See, that way we keep the membership of AboveTopSecret.com guessing all the time.
Oh, speaking of guessing all the time, who could have guessed what a fine, wonderful adventure we went on with our guest, Dr. Raymond Moody?
I didn't know what to expect, really.
Right.
I mean, he was jumping right in there with some funny stuff, so it was really a hoot. I'm telling you, we've been blessed.
We certainly do think that our guest that we had on today could have easily, if you know how they say, if I would have turned left at the stop sign rather than turning right, I wouldn't have gotten into the accident. I'm telling you, if he had gone left instead of right, he could have easily been one of today's stand-up comics.
I'm telling you, this guy was funny, especially when he got into his little imaginary town story.
It was a soap opera in itself.
And just before anybody starts saying, boy, you guys don't sound the same, let me tell you that prior to the interview with Dr. Moody, Johnny was having some computer problems. We got down to, we had to get online with him, and so I had to connect Johnny via phone. And, of course, we always connect to our guests via phone. So that's the reason why Johnny sounds like he's on the telephone and not in the studio, is because he's on telephone.
Hello!
Hello! Anyway, thousands of apologies to all our listeners around the world. But, you know, but at least it shows that we're capable of making executive decisions at the last spur of the moment. I mean, what other decision were we going to make? Clairvoyance? I don't think so, baby puppy.
I'll be sending you my questions via telepathy.
Yeah. By the way, I've got to give you compliments. Kudos. Thousand kudos. Boy, talk about just, I guess we've gotten so used to each other, John. We don't even need that little pop-up screen anymore because, man, you jumped right in there, and then I jumped right in, and we just back and forth. And it was just a load, load, load of fun.
Well, yeah. I don't know. For some reason, my mind just drifted there when you said load of fun, and I was thinking of what Dr. Moody told us about one of his little pamphlets, which our listeners are going to hear about.
Yeah, let's let them listen to the show for that little turdette.
I'm pretty sure all our listeners world round are going to really enjoy this interview with Dr. Raymond Moody.
ATS Mix.
Yeah, listen up.
From Above Top Secret.
Jesus Christ.
.com. Featured interview.
This is going to be a very interesting interview for both you and I, Dave. And let me tell you a little bit, and all our listeners worldwide, who we are going to be talking with. Holding both a PhD from the University of Virginia and an MD from the Medical College of Georgia, Raymond Moody is considered to be the foremost expert on the near-death experience phenomenon. He's appeared on many television programs as an expert guest about such subjects as out-of-body experiences, activities of cults, interconnections between humor and health, and the relationship of the paranormal to the performing arts. In 1988, Dr. Moody received the World Humanitarian Award, as well as a bronze medal in the Human Relations category at the New York Film Festival for the movie version of Life After Life. This award-winning author and impassioned researcher has written numerous books, including Life After Life, Life After Loss, Reflections on Life After Life, Reunions, The Last Laugh. He's also created a facility named the Dr. John D. Memorial Theater of the Mind. This facility allows people to experience altered states of consciousness for the purposes of education, entertainment, and spiritual advancement. It is with great pleasure for the ATS Mix team to have with us today Dr. Raymond Moody. Hello, Raymond, and welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Well, we really appreciate it, Raymond, because I know you're much sought after by a lot of people to hear your reflections on things. So, you know, let's get to it. First off, I've got to ask you, I like asking a lot of questions. So would you mind just explaining to the membership worldwide and a lot of our guests what parapsychology really is?
Well, you know, I don't count myself as a parapsychologist, and I'll tell you why. What I study, among other things, are near-death experiences, the experiences of people who come very close to death and in that time have some sort of profound spiritual experience, which typically changes their lives very dramatically and convinces them that what we call death is a transition into another state of reality.
Right.
And my background, my initial PhD was in philosophy. I was a philosophy professor for a while. I am, since the age of 18, I have just been utterly fascinated by the early Greek philosophers up to Plato and Aristotle. And that is sort of my central field, along with ancient Greek philosophy and logic and philosophy of language. Then I went to medical school and got my MD degree, and then went back to the University of Virginia and did my psychiatry residency. So,
right.
I don't count myself as a parapsychologist. Parapsychologists are people who tell you that they think they can use the scientific method to give you proof or evidence of life after death or something like that. I don't fall in that category at all, because I don't think that the question of life after death, which is the most important question we can ask, absolutely, but I don't think it's yet a scientific question. I think that before we can study the question of life after death with science, we've got to really work on the concept a little more clearly.
Exactly.
People really don't have a clear-cut idea of what they even mean by life after death. Now, they may think they do. When people talk about life after death, they think they're making sense. But as soon as you start really bearing down on it and trying to figure out what we're talking about here, it dissolves. Like, if you think about it, the sentence, there is life after death, it's a self-contradiction. I mean, what we mean by death is the state beyond which there's no life. So I think that we are really into very difficult philosophical and conceptual questions here, and they, to me, are the most interesting. Well, that's the most interesting and fascinating question of all, isn't it, whether there is something beyond this that we're in now.
Oh, yeah, I think that's the ultimate question that people want to know.
Absolutely. In fact, Dr. Moody, in your research, could you tell us whereabouts in recorded history? I know, after doing a little bit of research myself, that Plato, I believe, spoke about it briefly. And but how far in our recorded history do we have accounts of near-death experiences?
Well, to me, I am so focused on the Greeks that I don't know much else. You know, I've been reading that stuff since I was 18 years old. My wife, when she gets mad at me, she says, go upstairs and play with your friends. And what she means is read Herodotus and Aristophanes and Plato and so on. And all I know is that by the time of Plato, which was about 2,300 years ago, the Greeks had understood for some time by that time
right.
that certain people, when they come close to death and almost die and recover, will have these extraordinary states of consciousness. You know, the man who was a contemporary of Plato, who figured out that contrary to what we see in sense experience, that everything we see has to be made up of tiny little bits of matter that are too small to be seen by the eyes, which he called atoms. That was Democritus about 2,300 years ago. And like Plato, he studied these near-death experiences. He thought it was fascinating that people who almost die would come back with this story, which led other people to believe who heard them that this was some sort of evidence of life after death. And Plato was convinced. It's very plain when you read his Republic, where he describes this very dramatic near-death experience of a warrior, who was believed dead on the battlefield but revived. And it's very plain that Plato takes this very, very seriously, and sort of accepts it as revealing an afterlife. But Democritus, about the same time, wrote a book on near-death experiences and other phenomena related to almost dying. Unfortunately, we don't have Democritus's book because, unlike Plato, he didn't have a school. Plato had the school, which we know now as the university system that we have. Academia was set up by Plato. But Democritus's school, it didn't have the school, so we don't have his works intact like we do Plato's.
Right.
But from the little pieces, bits and pieces, fragments of Democritus's book on the afterlife, which survived, we can tell that he believed that these near-death experiences were just the winding down of the brain, just as we hear medical materialists talking about today. And Democritus made the very interesting observation. He said, you know, there's no such thing as a moment of death. And what he was getting at there is that these experiences are just the sort of final gasps, the dying brain. It's got to go back before the ancient Greeks, but
sure. That's
where I sort of lose track of it.
Right.
Well, if you lose track of it there, then I have absolutely no hope whatsoever, Raymond. I want to let everybody know about your website, which is www.lifeafterlife.com. I'm on your site right now, and I mean, the one thing I love about the way we do our interview process, of course, John's screwed because his computer's down and he's having problems. And I found something on here that I found most interesting.
Uh-huh.
It is a way to where people can contact you, because a lot of the stuff that you do on a personal basis.
That's right.
Your tours and stuff, but you do your main thing is doing things on a personal basis. It says
You're
a private counselor. You work as a practitioner in counseling, consulting on a private individual basis, in person, by phone, or at the bedside of the dying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the line that strikes me, Raymond, and I want you to kind of elaborate a little bit on it.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact, because of experiencing the death of my wife's mother, we were at her bedside. Is it common that hour or 2 hours or a period of time before a person passes on, that they start seeing people that have passed before them and start talking to them? I've heard this on more than one occasion. I find this amazing.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. I have seen that ever since I first started being at the bedside of the dying when I was in medical school.
Right.
This is just something you see with people on the terminal phase, where they, and as you can probably attest yourself from your experience, they are completely clear and coherent.
It's
not like their minds are wandering.
No,
they're carrying
right.
on these completely coherent conversations with people who passed away. Yes, this is a very common thing, including all sorts of other extraordinary things that we don't hear so much about.
Okay, like what?
Everybody hears about the near-death experiences, for example, where people come back from a close call and have this experience to tell about of leaving their bodies and going into a light and seeing their relatives and seeing their life pass in review and so on. But what's not so well known is that it's also very common for bystanders at the bedside of the dying loved one,
right,
that when that person in the bed passes away, the bystanders themselves will have these same features that we think of as the near-death experience. They tell us that they seem to leave their physical bodies and go part way into this light with their dying relative. So then when they come out of this experience, their relative is there dead in the bed while they've come back to their body with the feeling that they empathically co-lived the dying experience of their loved one who did die. And these empathic death experiences, I think, are on the order of about the same amount of, on the order of the same commonality, I think, as the near-death experiences we know of. And this raises a really interesting dilemma because, you know, the thing that comes very naturally to people's minds in this world that we lived in, which is kind of bound a lot by what we call scientism, that is the idea that people have that the only way of establishing knowledge or finding truth is through the scientific method. And so they look at this and these near-death experiences and they say, well, this is obviously the chemistry of the dying brain or hallucinations that are thrown up as the oxygen is deprived from the brain and so on.
Right.
But if that's true, then why would the bystanders have that same set of experiences when they are not even physiologically compromised? So I'm not saying, I just have no idea whether these near-death experiences have anything to do with life after death or not. But I do know this much, that they are, I think, a lot more complex and complicated phenomenon than this sort of simple-minded idea that it's just the brain chemistry tries to portray.
I'm curious, Dr. Moody, would you say that, let's take for an example, an atheist, would an atheist experience a near-death experience the same way as, say, a Christian?
That does happen all the time. Yes, it does. But now let me say this, too. Sometimes people reason that, now first of all, what I say we can accept as fact is that quite frequently people who prior to this experience have no particular religious background or were agnostics or sometimes even atheists, and yet they have this experience and they come back and they say, well, I was wrong, you know, that I did have this passage into another dimension. But because people say this, then we may listen to that and we say, well, that somehow makes the experience more, quote, objective, unquote, because we assume that a person who was an atheist, that means that these ideas weren't in that person's mind, so that they could have been projected out there at the end as a kind of, but you know, there's a big fallacy in that, and that is that no matter whether they are atheists or not, everybody is going to be exposed to some degree, especially in American society, to these religious ideas. And so who is to say that even if a person, say, was an atheist prior to the experience, nonetheless, they had been exposed to ideas about life after death and God. Everybody has. So just because a person said, you know, was prior to this an atheist, and then after the experience concludes that, well, no, there really is a life after death, we can't really say on that basis that they're more objective than anybody else would be. I mean, it doesn't follow from the fact that they weren't religious before, that therefore their experience is more compelling evidence of the reality of this.
Well, I know for a fact that you really started out your kind of your search or your for your Holy Grail, if you would, in your field, that you were involved in stargazing. Can you tell me a little bit about when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been age seven. The first book I ever checked out of the grammar school library when I was seven, I believe, was a book on astronomy. I still remember that book to this day. And I'm still just, you know, I'm an astronomy nut and have been since the age of seven. And actually, I don't have my telescope anymore because when the Hubble went up, I figured, well, what's the point of this thing anymore now?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's,
and so, but no, so I don't do any direct observation anymore. But I have always loved astronomy. And yeah, that was my first life path. I went to the University of Virginia when I was 18 with the intention of getting my PhD in astronomy. But I had also been very interested from an early age in philosophy. And so when I got to UVA at age 18 and started reading The Republic, I got hooked in the first few pages. So just within the first few days of going to the University of Virginia, I decided I was going to be a philosophy major. And I've never regretted it. You know, I've an interesting thing happens to you, to people, I think, when they're about 50 years of age. And I saw it because coming from a very conservative town, when I used to go back in my college days and afterward over the holidays, there would always be parties where you sat around with the people that you grew up with, you know, and the question would always be, well, Raymond, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm studying philosophy. Philosophy, what can you do with that? You know?
And, I love the voice change.
And that same thing happened year after year after year through my 20s and 30s and 40s.
Right.
And then I noticed when I got about 50, those same people and those same parties, you see, started saying, they would say, oh, Raymond, what are you doing now? Oh, I'm still studying philosophy. And now it's a whole different attitude. Oh, they say, I wish so much I had studied philosophy. Because I think what happens naturally to us in the aging process, during the midlife process, is that people who had spent the rest of their earlier part of their life wrapped up in the business concerns or making a living or whatever, they suddenly wake up to the you know, the very profound nature of these really big questions of existence, like life after death and whether there is a God and all of these things. These big spiritual questions really start bearing down on people when they get about 50, I think.
Well, I know that you have a kind of a passion for this next subject as we kind of bounce around here between subjects. And I also, if I recall correctly, you mentioned before we started this interview that you are working on a book about this particular subject.
Yes.
But let's talk a little bit in a humorous vein, if we may. Tell us why humor is so important to you, Dr. Moody.
Well, again, it all goes back to childhood. I should have said more technically that when I was 7 or 8, the first things I ever wanted to be were an astronomer and a comedian. And, you know, really, to me, throughout my life, laughter and humor are one of the greatest pleasures. To me, just that wonderful feeling of laughing and the wonderful feeling that humor brings to us. And so, to me, it's really just hedonism. I mean, it's just so much fun. But then on top of that, when you start, people have always, friends of mine, and, you know, people I get to know, have always thought of me as a funny person. I was a prankster, and I wrote a lot of parodies. And before I wrote my book, Life After Life, I had written this little book in 1971 called Caprology. And it was just a parody. It was when I was teaching at East Carolina University, teaching philosophy at that time. And at that time, there was a lot of interest among the students in astrology and palmistry and that sort of thing. So one day, a student in my logic class just said out of the blue, she said, Dr. Moody, what do you think about astrology? Well, because I was trying to work a logic problem on board, that sudden shift of consciousness right. got me thinking and hit that funny part of my brain. And I said, well, you know, some people say they can tell your fortune by the lines on your palm or the bumps on your head or the way your stars are aligned at birth. But I said, you know, I've always thought you could do just about as well by reading the stool. Well, I started drawing the different shapes on the board and all like this, and I wrote this little manual called Caprology about how to, with all the diagrams and the equipment you use and all, and just as a joke, and I got 100 copies of that thing printed up in 1972 with by the lithograph press, if you guys are old enough to remember those things.
Yes. Sure. I'm 59, so we're both. We ain't babies, babe.
Oh, great. So I had 100 copies printed up of that thing, and I sold them out in a week at $10 a
copy. Golly.
And the funny thing, I was in the Barnes & Noble a couple of days ago, and I saw this little book called, it's by two British humorist guys, a little book called something like 100 or 200 or whatever of the most bizarre books ever written. And it's mostly old British books from the 19th century. So right. I was looking through some of these wild things, and I turned the page, and there was Caprology by Raymond A. Moody. Yeah, I think that, you know, humor is just one of the most wonderful, you know, aspects of being a human being. And then if you just naturally appreciate humor and enjoy it, and then you're like me, you're sort of a curious person, then you start getting into this thing of, well, what in the name of God is it? You know, because humor is so familiar to us.
Right.
I think as an everyday reality, I think most people just don't think much about it. But as soon, yeah, about really. What it is, but as soon as you start thinking about how can this be, your mind just gets blown away. I mean, it is, believe it or not, the nature of humor is still one of the biggest unsolved riddles of the human mind. There's all kinds of theories, but we really just don't know what humor is in its deepest nature. But it sure is fun.
Oh, it's a blast. It really is. I want to talk just a little bit about one of the things that I have noted in doing research on you is that you received the World Humanitarian Award. Tell me a little bit about the reason why you got that award.
Well, that was a very nice group of folks back many years ago, and they were kind enough to present it to me over in Europe for my book, Life After Life, which they felt had comforted a lot of people, which I have felt very pleased about that myself. You know, I mean, when you look back on your life, of course, I think for most people, our personal things are what stand out the most. Like
exactly,
my four wonderful kids and my grandchild are the big sort of big thing in my life, and that's what I think about, and my friends. But then, you know, in terms of professional things, I think that that has been very gratifying that people all over the world have written me or talked with me and talked right. about how reading my book, Life After Life, about the near-death experiences had comforted them in a loss or had enabled them to understand that they were not alone in having their own experience, or that it got them on a new interest in life and a new professional track or whatever. All those things have been very, very gratifying. That's been a big part of my, I think, but probably thus far the nicest thing about my professional career.
Well, you know, that leads me to ask you this question, Raymond, and that is, I know for a fact, even though I am not near the level that you are, I know that letters that I received when I did my show back in Saigon and stuff, and people telling me, you know, what the show meant to them and stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of a validation that what you have a passion for actually touched lives. And I mean, to me, that was just worth more than all the money in the world.
It really is, isn't it? I mean, that's what, the older you get, the more you see that, you know, what it's all about is love and relationships.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this facility, the Dr. John D. Memorial Theater of the Mind.
Well,
I love that name, by the way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing to me that that some things in history that are bona fide fact are nonetheless so unbelievable that they are even too sensational for the National Enquirer. I mean, there are some things that are really, as I said, go to the history books and look these things up and see that they really did happen. But nonetheless, if you saw it in a tabloid by the in the grocery store, you wouldn't even pick it up because you'd say, oh, obviously this is made up.
Yeah.
Well, one of those things that is so incredible is that if you think about the fact that we're all thinking right now as we go through this, we're thinking as Westerners, we're using a logical system that came down to us ultimately from the ancient Greeks. Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and philosophers before them like Pythagoras and Parmenides. It was a long developmental process that created this Western way of thinking and logic, which has led to science and all of these amazing contributions of science. Well, if you ask where that came from, here is the bona fide, real, true answer. And that is, it came from these people who, to their contemporaries, to the people who lived at the same time, these ancient philosophers were regarded as evokers of the deceased. People who have read, for example, Plato's account of Socrates' trial will remember that in his trial, Socrates says, well, you know what people really have against me is that they say that I am a person who probes into things up in the air and down under the earth. And what this meant, these were code words, but that meant had to do with out-of-body experiences. In other words, magical flying by getting up above your body and flying. And the things under the earth meant, to the Greeks, the underworld was the realm of the spirit. And Aristophanes, for example, who was a comic playwright, who was a contemporary of Socrates, specifically in one of his plays, The Birds, accuses Socrates of being one of these evokers of the spirits of the dead. So the Greeks did this practice at these institutions, which really did exist, called oracles of the dead. The historian Herodotus writes about them. The historian Plutarch writes about them. The classical writers describe these places. And back in the mid-70s, the most famous of these oracles of the dead, the one that Herodotus mentions, the one that's in Homer's Odyssey, a very famous one, was sure. Actually relocated and excavated. And based on what the archaeologist found there, believe it or not, I actually was able to recreate this procedure and find out that it really does work. That you can take people through a process with certain kinds of equipment during which they will seem to see and converse with the spirit of a departed loved one in a full state of conscious waking awareness. And of course, you know, at this point, I hope a lot of listeners are saying, oh my God, this is a psychotic man on the radio, because that would be the rational person's response. But the fact is that since I published this result about, oh, I guess 15 or so years ago now, many other people have, psychologists have tried this procedure out and found out and got it to work just like I did. So it really does work. What I figured out the Greeks were doing was that they had an underground chamber. What they used was a big bronze cauldron, highly polished on the inside and filled with water.
Okay.
Then a layer of olive oil. And in a dark chamber by torchlight, after preparation, many people gazing into these depths will see these full-color, moving, three-dimensional visions of the deceased.
Right.
And so what I did was I used a mirror in a darkened room with a candlelight or a dim light bulb, And right. the mirror is arranged so that the person sits in a chair in front of it, but it's angled so that they don't see their own reflection. They're just gazing into an infinite depth. And after preparation, which is simply to get them to reminisce about a selected person they died and to sort of talk about their feelings and to bring up the good memories and the bad memories, this process can go on for an hour or two. They sit in that room and they gaze into the chamber, and I mean into the mirror, and many people, about half of them on the very first attempt, will have some sort of experience which they take to be an actual contact with a departed loved one.
Now,
yes,
is this the...
and it sounds so crazy, doesn't it? But it
really, it really doesn't.
Let's face it, it really does. You know, that's the thing about it. It's so extraordinary that that's why, in part, for centuries, scholars who read these things, and the Greek historians, and even the Greek geographer Strabo, for example, wrote about it. But even all those, even all these eminent classical writers wrote about this. Scholars just didn't believe it. It couldn't be. But it really was. It really was. This does work.
I think it's amazing, Raymond.
It is amazing. I've done hundreds of people through this now, and we continue to do them once in a while. And it is amazing to hear the stories people have when they come out of there. It's just astonishing.
Now, is this the psychomantium you're speaking of?
That's right. The psychomantium is the Greek word for the underground facilities where they carried on these evocation procedures. And actually, there is a little bit of evidence that some of these philosophers really did, these early philosophers really did work at this. Matter of fact, one of the early philosophers who was an instrumental person in the history of science and philosophy, who came up with the notion of impersonal force and even foresaw the theory of evolution, was Empedocles, who also was admittedly one of these evokers of the spirits, who called up the spirits of the deceased.
Hmm. Has there ever been, like, negative experiences that have been associated with the psychomantium?
No, there haven't. But you know something? I bet you could arrange that if you wanted to. I mean, you could probably it's all about hell, and look at these images of these flaming monsters, and But another thing about this is this, that sometimes people worry about this, you know, say, oh, aren't you fooling around with the forces of the universe here? You know, who knows what you might call up through that mirror this might be, But I say, when I hear people talk like that, I say, look, get a grip. I mean, if you think about it.
Johnny and I have to tell people that all the time, Raymond.
That's right. Human beings, I have studied the history of mirrors, and human beings have been manufacturing mirrors for at least 6,000 years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Before that, they were looking into ponds and so on and seeing reflections. And then, and every house has several mirrors. I mean, every day you look into the mirror numerous times. Let's face it, if there was any danger in looking into a mirror, we would know it by now. So
sure.
I think this is a perfectly safe procedure.
Right. I got one follow-up question, and then I'll toss it over to Dave, and that is it necessary for someone to go to the Dr. John D. Memorial Theater of the Mind or to experience the psychomantium, or could the average person possibly get the same results outside of a controlled environment, say perhaps their own place of living?
Oh, yes, sir. As a matter of fact, this was a common folk practice in the United States up to a century ago. If you go back and look at some of the iconography from 100 years ago on old postcards and so on, you'll see this very commonly, that people knew that in a darkened room by candlelight, you could sit and you could gaze into the mirror and see spirits. And this was just a common folk practice. I think it probably dropped out around 100 years ago, because with the advent of radio and then with television, instead of having, parlor activities and sitting around in the living room doing things together, people
sure.
would first listen to the radio and then watched the TV, so this dropped out. But it was well known as a folk practice even in the U.S. until very recently.
Well, you know, because I want to test your range of your humor meter that you have there, Raymond. You have seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Jack Nicholson that you know portrayed. I note from my research that you were a forensic psychiatrist
I
in
sure
a maximum was. Security Georgia State Hospital.
I sure was.
So I mean, you don't have to. I don't want you naming names. You don't want to get us all sued. But I mean, was there anybody you know walking around that was trying to play like a loon and really wasn't, or did you find them pretty much legit in there?
Well, you know, the idea of somebody faking a psychosis, especially for a long period of time, that would be extremely rare. And
right.
Also, by and large, people who malinger mental illness, you know, they malinger not what, they don't make an accurate representation of mental illness. They make a representation of what the average person thinks a mental illness
exactly.
is like.
Exactly.
You know, they used to say that military psychiatrists, for example, would say that they could tell when somebody was malingering because it was a very common thing in the military at one time for soldiers who wanted to get off duty or whatever would say that they would tell the psychiatrist that they were seeing a big rabbit and presumably picked up from that James Stewart movie. So
yes,
there are different
that's
like
where I was going with it,
malinger.
Too.
But no, the situation I was in was not exactly the kind of thing where malingering would be high on your list. I mean, these were severely psychotic, quite violent.
Right.
I mean, it was not a question of these people trying to get a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity so they could get off. I mean, these
yeah,
people were saying,
and that's where I
killed him because he was, you know, the God told me to, and I saw the, you know, this was Satan. I mean, these were really, really just... This is kind of like, this is genuine National Enquirer stuff. I mean, my day-to-day job was to talk with the kind of people you read about in the National Enquirer who
right.
chop their mother and father into little bits. And, you know,
yeah.
that's an interesting job because when you go home in the evening, what do you talk about with your family?
That's where
you know?
I was going with
what
this
did
thing.
You
yeah.
do today, Daddy? Oh, I talked to a man who battered his grandmother to death with a baseball. You know, it's not a good topic.
Well, what did you do, honey? Oh, well, we went to the grocery store as normal.
That's right.
Well, something I've always kind of found kind of interesting is we have patients that are in the hospitals that claim that they hear and receive voices and messages, and yet we have others that are walking around in the world that are going on the lecture circuit collecting $25,000 in appearance that claim the same thing.
Well, that's right. Let's see. You're right. And gosh, for $25,000 in appearance, I might claim such a thing. Oh, can you get me a gig like that?
Well, how does one actually, you know, decipher? How can one decrypt the psychosis of one but not in the other?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, you know something, that's an easy question to ask in a theoretical way, but, you know, schizophrenia, manic illness, paranoia, those things, people who've seen a lot of that will tell you that there is something about people with schizophrenia, for example, they are sick. In other words, this is some kind of neurological thing. It's inherited. We know that very conclusively from demographic studies that have been made and everything. And we don't know yet which genes cause schizophrenia, and we don't know yet which particular chemicals it is that get into the brain that cause this kind of thing. But we will know eventually. It's just a matter of time. And what we're dealing here with is something sick. It's a sickness. And it would have to be, I mean, anybody who would want, for some bizarre reason, to act out the role of a schizophrenic for years and years and years, and for what reason, I don't know. they would do better to use that acting power to get an Academy Award, you know, and enjoy it that way, because this is not something I mean. I tell you, the people I dealt with know this is, you know, and another thing, I think the public has this idea that if somebody is found not guilty by reason of insanity, well, they're going to go off to this nice resort, right? And, believe me, the unit for the criminally insane, that is a much more horrific environment than any prison you could imagine. I mean,
I can imagine,
been into prisons. I didn't do it. I have been in prisons. No, just kidding. To visit and everything. And I've been in units for the criminally insane. And believe me, it's a unit for the criminally insane is not a place where somebody would want to go to sort of get a lighter time of it. In the place where I was, we had to keep the television set in a chain, you know, that chain link hurricane fence.
Right.
We built a cage out of that stuff to put the television in, because these people would grab the television and throw it, and you know, it's constantly assaults, and you know, people who had all kinds of really exotic delusions. And one man told me, you know, he was convinced he was the king of England. Another man convinced he was a lion. Another man worshipped pigeons. I mean, oh my God!
He worshipped pigeons.
Oh yes.
You know, Johnny and I have met a few people at the San Jose UFO Expo that we weren't really sure about.
Well, I tell you, now I always saw about the maximum security unit I worked in. I said, gosh, I've seen most psychotic people in that ward that I have ever seen outside the Washington, D.C. Railways Terminal.
We've got one of those terminals in Dallas. I got news for you. That's such a great line, Raymond. You were just sharp as a tack. Well, I got one more question I want to ask you, and then Johnny, if you'll kind of wrap up with your last question, because we've taken a great amount of your time, and we really can't tell you enough, Raymond, how much we appreciate it.
Oh my goodness, this is just so much fun. I mean, you guys are, it's like, you know, if people tell me, "Oh, Raymond, you're so smart," I'm always thinking, "Oh my goodness, now what's wrong with them?" Because I know that I am dumb, okay? But if somebody tells me, "Hey, you're a funny guy," I say, "Now there is a receptive person."
Now see, there, Johnny and I got to be receptive. We love you, Raymond. I don't care what your wife says, you know? But here's my question. I mean, you know, with all the things that you've experienced with all the years of your education and everything that you've tried to do and tried to accomplish, have you ever had any personal experiences with any of the things that you're involved with?
Well, a little bit I have, in the sense that I almost died. I have I had autoimmune thyroiditis when I was in my 20s, unbeknownst to it took a long time to diagnose. So I ended up with a horrific thyroid problem called myxedema, and I nearly died. And so I didn't have a full-blown near-death experience, but like I like to say that I got close enough to see the city limit sign. Then I had, in connection with my own work on the psychomantion, I did see a very vivid full color three-dimensional moving talking apparition of my deceased grandmother.
Really?
But I have no idea what to make of those things. To me, the basic problem is still that we can have these experiences. They can inspire us very deeply. They can change our lives. But just to be completely honest, we still don't really have the logical equipment. That is the system of reasoning and concepts that would be needed to make sense of this. We are dealing here with the life, with life's deepest mystery. And thus far, it is beyond the rational process as we know it. And I'm not saying that we never will comprehend the question of life after death. I'm saying that if we do, it's not going to be initially a scientific discovery. First, we will have to work out whole new concepts or whole new ways of reasoning about things to get to that point.
Well, I would kind of like to do a little follow-up question, if I could. If someone had a loved one that may be old in their years and are possibly very close to facing death, would it be wise for us to initiate humor into their life and to let them know that there's nothing to be afraid of in death?
You know, that is always a matter of the individual situation. Now, I will say two things about it. Number one, over the years, a lot of terminally ill people have mentioned to me, and these were usually people who were very humorous or had appreciated humor in their life. They would specifically say, you know, after I developed this terminal illness, nobody wants to joke around with me anymore. Nobody tells jokes. Nobody's funny anymore. So, yeah, I have seen that where people who love humor, then when they receive this diagnosis, other people around them sort of, you know, won't participate anymore. And that people can experience that as a loss. You know, I always loved what Dr. Seuss said on his deathbed as he was winding down. You know, it's like the long, long illness, and he was lying there on his deathbed. And he looked up one day at his wife, and he said, am I dead yet? And what I have found in my practice is that people who respond to life with humor and use humor as a way of getting on in life, they will use it in their process of dealing with a terminal illness, too. And on the other hand, I always take the lead from the patient. In other words, I have never gone to some patient that I had who was terminally ill. Never have I, in a situation like that, said to anybody, well, let me tell you these things that these people tell us who come back from death. They get out of their body and so on. I've never done that. Yeah. Everybody has to deal with death in their own way. On the other hand, there have been plenty of times during my long career that a patient would say something to me like, you know, I know I'm passing away. I know, you know, in the last few days or weeks here. Do we know anything about the process of what it is like in that last part? And when the patient would ask me in that way, I think you're almost obligated to say, well, yes, I mean, we don't know what to make of these things. We don't know what conclusions to draw. But yes, it is true that quite a number of patients who return from almost dying will have this same sort of story to tell. So, I mean, what I'm getting at here is that it's a matter of judgment in each individual case. Practically no two people are alike, and you have to sort of do the best you can in sort of feeling them out and see what the best thing to do. The best thing to do, and as a general rule, is to listen and to let people talk about their concerns during the terminal process and to just to be there for them and to lend an ear. I think that's the most important thing.
You know, it's funny that you should mention that, and then we're going to bring this to a close. But it's funny that you should mention that. It reminds me of something that transpired when my wife's mother, before she was put into the hospital, she still was able to conduct her affairs and whatever at this point. This is a day or two before she went in, and then she died of heart failure. But she's sitting on the bed. I'll never forget this, Raymond, as long as I live. It'll stick with me till the day I die. She's sitting on the bed, and I can tell she's scared about going into the hospital, because I think she herself realizes that she's not going to come back out this time. And we're sitting there talking and whatever, I don't know why I came up with this. It was just because I've always kind of jacked with her. I've always been a comedian, a class clown, And I said, Mom, I said, you know, maybe you're looking at this the wrong way, you know. And she says, well, what do you mean? And I says, well, I mean, let's say you have two choices of how to die. Mm-hmm. Would you rather, you know, die in a bed with all your loved ones around you that have, you know, dearly love you and are there with you? Or would you rather die by stepping off of a curb and getting smashed by a bus?
Uh-huh.
And she started laughing. Mm-hmm. She says, you know what? And I can't say this because of SEC compliance rules, but she says, you're a blanking nut. and with that, I put her in her wheelchair. We took her to the hospital, and of course, she never came back out. But the fact that I got her laughing,
yep.
You know,
yep.
it took her mind. It's just exactly what you said. It took her mind
yep.
off of
yep.
the imminent situation, and a humor thing turned something that was really sad into something to where she got a laugh.
That's absolutely right. Humor is, I mean, it's very mysterious, and it is so much fun.
Well, you know who you remind me of?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no.
No, who? I don't know.
you remind me of Patch Adams.
Patch Adams. I have met Patch once about 20 or 30 years ago, but I haven't seen him since.
Robin Williams portrayed Patch Adams uh-huh. in the movie Patch Adams. He said he did basically... or at least that's the way it was portrayed, exactly what you've been talking mm-hmm. about off and on for you know, going on an hour now. Mm-hmm. And he addressed everything, including death,
yep.
you know, with humor.
Yep.
And I know for a fact, because I read his book, and I don't read very many books, but I read his book, mm-hmm. and he talks about how the same things that you have described about treating people with respect, but doing yep. something in a humorous way to make it not so... scary and not so dark for them, you know?
Yep. Right. And, well, you know, if you think about it, the whole notion of life after death is an inherently comic notion. Now, let me explain what that means. I'm not putting it down. What I'm saying is comedy is one of the great blessings of life. And right. what technically comedy is the form of discourse that portrays a happy ending, right? Now,
exactly.
if you think about it, comedy, I mean, the idea of life after death is the ultimate form of comedy, because we contrast comedy with tragedy, which ends in death. But the idea of life after death is a comic notion that is so broad that it even sort of swallows up tragedy. In other words, that even death, the end of the tragedy, is comic. In that it has a happy ending. We do
right.
live after we die,
wow.
according to some. And I got to tell you the truth, even after all these, I just have no idea myself. I really don't.
Hey, we love your honesty.
yeah. And see, Raymond, I got to tell you something. You've made two new fans with Johnny and Dave
hey,
here.
Hey, great. Well, this is wonderful.
Because I tell you're a hoot, my friend. You are a hoot.
Hey, well, that's great. We'll have to do this some more and talk about all my people in my little town that I made up, like Dr. Mitchell and then Heater Boy and all my friends. We've had a horrible time in Bubbadale recently. Dr. Mitchell has diagnosed Madam Petunia, Bubbadale's best psychic, with a bad case of fortune teller's dementia.
Oh, boy.
And he says that she's complaining that... beginning to cut into her business a little bit. This client went in the other day and found the poor old thing trying to read tea leaves with her Ouija board. And Dr. Mitchell said that's about as far down into fortune teller's dementia as you can get when you start trying to read tea leaves with a Ouija board. But then she was talking to Dr. Mitchell, and she said, you know, several times lately, when she's been foreseeing something, she has this strange feeling that she has foreseen it before. But Dr. Mitchell said, not to worry about that. He said it was common for fortune tellers to have a little touch of that. He said they call it deja preview.
Well, I know what her problem is, Dr. Moody.
Yeah?
Yeah, you see, she should have gotten a hold of that little pamphlet, and instead of reading tea leaves, she could have been reading the stool.
That's right. That's
right. Well, this and more. Oh, the soap opera from Dr. Moody's Town can be yours if you go and visit his website at www.lifeafterlife.com. I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to have you on our show, Dr. Moody. You've made Dave and I both cry laughing.
Well, this is
I tell you, you're a hoot, Dr. Moody. I don't like I said. I don't care what your family says about you behind your back. you're tops in our book, brother.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much. This is great.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Moody. You've been a great guest, and we really appreciate your time, sir. And say hello to Cheryl for us.
Oh, well, hope I'll talk with you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Raymond.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Johnny Anonymous here. Just wanted to let you know that after a long day of denying ignorance at the Above Top Secret area or denying apathy at the Above Politics area, I like to go to the Below Top Secret arena and just have some fun denying boredom. It doesn't matter if I'm in the mood to just chit-chat with some of the other members and friends or share a good joke. I can do that and so much more in the Below Top Secret forum. In fact, I just got a great recipe for marinating steaks in the food and cooking arena. It was so good that my lady friend just couldn't believe that I found it on that website. You found that at BelowTopSecret.com, she asked? Yes, my dearest, I replied. At BelowTopSecret.com, it's like a one-stop shop of fun and information. They've got areas like travel, health and wellness, music, literature, entertainment, art, and sports. They even have sections that you can rant in, talk about your faith and spirituality, learn about the coolest websites on the net, or even just talk about your latest relationship. Or maybe you're more into breaking news events, urban legends, or even an area that offers you some help on fixing that broken-down DeSoto your dad has collecting dust in his garage. Well, friends, I've got to tell you that I've got her hooked, and now she and her friends all go to BelowTopSecret.com and hang out in the numerous areas on the forum. So if you're looking to deny boredom, maybe you should stop by www.BelowTopSecret.com and start having some fun, too.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. Thank you.